Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, you are very welcome to The Tonight Show. Tonight, we ask if an Irish COVID inquiry will be a political pantomime or a necessary next step.
We see what was done well, and we bank that, and we embed it, and we remember it for the next pandemic, because pandemics will come again. But then we also look at other areas in which things could have been done better.
As sales of electric vehicles rev up, we debate whether they are worth an investment. And nearly 11 years since the shooting of Reeva Steenkamp in South Africa, Oscar Pistorius will be released on parole tomorrow. From revealing WhatsApp messages to shocking statements from former cabinet members, the ongoing UK COVID inquiry has gripped the public and press alike. But the terms of an Irish inquiry into our own response to the pandemic are expected to be before cabinet shortly. But what questions should be asked, and will it descend into political mudslinging? Well, here to discuss this further is Fianna Fáil TD, John Lahart, journalist Michael O'Regan, Professor of Health Systems at DCU, Anthony Staines, GP, Dr. Brendan O'Shea, and down the line is Chairwoman of Care Champions, an advocacy group that offers support to those who have faced issues with nursing homes, Magella Beattie. You're all very welcome to the programme. Michael, I'm going to come to you first, because I am conscious that for a lot of people, they hear the word COVID and they just want to cover their ears. But an inquiry like this, a review, call it what you may, it is important, because if you think back, and sometimes we forget to, you know, what was it, 4 or 5 years ago, this was an extraordinary period of time in people's lives with extraordinary restrictions put on the way we live our lives.
Absolutely. And I think that while some people might say, oh God, not COVID again, this is necessary. Now, the Taoiseach has said that he wants the inquiry to be a search for the truth and not a witch hunt. And I think people will agree with him in that. It's to be set up probably within the next 3 months. The terms of reference have to be agreed by the cabinet. It could last, it's estimated, up to anything like 18 months. Now, it's a significant year politically, because you have the European and local elections and the possibility of a general election in the autumn. And if it doesn't happen in the autumn, the certainty of a general election in the spring of next year. So the political temperature will be rising anyway. Now, I think what people will inevitably say, will it turn out to be like the UK inquiry? I don't think so.
And let's just remind people, in the UK, we have had these pretty explosive WhatsApp messages. Yeah. We've had testimony from Boris Johnson himself, from Rishi Sunak, from advisors within cabinet that spoke about a toxic environment. I mean, it was a mess, and it has been political mudslinging over there for the last number of weeks. But you could say, in some ways, there's nothing we don't know about how COVID was dealt with in the UK after it. We're not going to get that here.
I think the government on balance handled it well. Now, that doesn't mean that everything that was done was the right thing to do at the right time. That's what an inquiry has to show. But there weren't any wine parties in government buildings, you know.
So no text messages between Leo Varadkar and Tony Holohan. We're not expecting those.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the UK inquiry, you had this bizarre situation where both the Prime Minister at the time, Boris Johnson, and the current Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, said that they had lost their WhatsApp messages. Now, this is echoes of the Watergate scandal in the United States, where you had the tapes from the White House, critical tapes which implicated Nixon in the cover-up, suddenly and inexplicably, quote, erroneously, unquote, erased. It led eventually, of course, to the resignation of Nixon. And the British government clearly was dysfunctional during COVID. You had, for instance, the astonishing remark by Dominic Cummings, a strange man, Johnson's chief advisor, where he said at one stage, he described the prime minister as careering around on WhatsApp, as usual, creating chaos and undermining everybody. Now, you're not going to have any senior official from the government saying anything remotely like that about Leo Varadkar or Micheál Martin.
Because by and large, you felt we dealt with it pretty well.
I think
well.
We did. And I think in retrospect, the state of the nation addresses by Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar were quite good and quite balanced and I think quite effective.
OK, so what's the purpose then of this inquiry, John Hart? What do we need to find out? What do we need to learn?
I think it's really important. There was a book written about the Spanish flu by Ida Milne, and one of the things she said was that you had a society that was so worn out by the First World War, by the period of revolution, that the last thing they wanted to do was talk about the Spanish flu. And so the state missed a huge opportunity to learn really significant lessons. And it was kind of lost in the public mind and lost in folklore as a result of that. And you were quite right when you said, you know, most people put their hands to their ears. Facebook, when they hear COVID, Facebook occasionally throws up, you know, these photographic memories. I forgot, for example, that the doll, and I do forget, that the doll spent a lot of time in the convention centre. Mm-hmm. Because it feels like it was a different era. Building on what Ida Milne has said, we need to look back to see what we did right, and I think we got a lot right. What, as Sam McConkie said on the radio today, what were the real resiliences? What were the weaknesses? What, you know, didn't go right? I think of things like, and I know you have a guest here, there wasn't a public representative not impacted by stories from week to week. The ones that come to my mind, I'm not prioritising them, but they were towards the end, was, you know, the spouses who couldn't attend the labour of their partner. And very often, and we kept pushing it, very often we didn't get satisfactory answers to that. So we need to see, you know, what we did well, but I think it ought to be fact-based. I think,
yeah, because Leo Varadkar,
that kind of apportion blame, really, they get mired down in lawyers and mired down in really not kind of finding solutions. So what
he
we
has
want
said,
is,
Leo Varadkar yeah. said, look, we need to get the terms of reference of this right. We don't want it to stray into all sorts of things, was what he said, like they did in the UK. So what sorts of things do we not want to stray into?
Well, I think the terms of reference should set out very, very clearly from the start that these are the objectives of this inquiry. And the objectives are to leave us in a better place the next pandemic or the next crisis we face. And I always bear in mind, I'm a member of the Oireachtas Health Committee and I was a member of the COVID Health Committee in the interregnum period between government. And we had lots of different witnesses in. Let's not forget, you know, the cyber attack on the HSE caused the HSE far more problems than COVID did and caused the country's health system far more problems and posed a much more significant problem and challenge to the health system, actually, than COVID did.
Micheál Martin, yourself, you just said it there, Leo Varadkar, when they've been in here last year, we've asked them about the COVID inquiry. They're sort of at pains to point out this can't be a witch hunt. This isn't really about individuals. Why? Why are they so afraid, it would seem, to talk about accountability and responsibility?
I don't think they are. There's an awful lot of stuff on the public record already through books that were written by colleagues of yourself, Michael, good journalists. Really
colleagues
good books.
Of ours here, Richard
and colleagues
Chambers.
Of yours, yeah, absolutely. And they really, I won't say they exposed, but they dealt with a lot of the background pieces. We did have a bit of an expose of text messages between different players in it as well. So there will be a little bit of colour, but I think what everybody wants to do is build on what we did really well. There's going to be challenges like this down the road. How do we leave ourselves much better place?
Okay.
To deal with
that? So one of the big questions then, Anthony, is how is this inquiry going to play out? You think it needs to be public. You mean full public inquiry?
I think it needs to be public, but I think it would be a very good idea to have a private arm where people could recount their own stories and be listened to. That worked well for the Commission to Inquire into Child Abuse. And I think that could be a model for here. But the focus has to be laser focused on being ready. We weren't ready for this pandemic. Neither was anyone else in Europe. Because the last serious pandemic was 1969. That's a long time ago. There's nobody still working who remembers that. But the last pandemic to hit Europe was a long time ago. The odds are that we're going to get more pandemics faster. So I don't think it's going to be 40 years before we have another pandemic. Hopefully it will be more than a couple of years. But I don't, nobody knows is the truth. So we have to figure out a mechanism for dealing with this, getting on top of it. And as Simon Harris said, learning from what we did that worked.
So what do you feel we did that did work and then didn't work?
What we did that worked was very rapid responses, very rapid rollout of vaccination, open communication, telling people what was going on. That all worked. It worked well. What didn't work was nursing homes were not sufficiently well-minded, and that's a serious mistake that I made and other people made. The idea that COVID was not spread in schools was wrong. The idea that COVID was spread by hand contact was wrong. COVID is spread through the air, hence filtration masks. We've got really got to have mechanisms for getting on top of that, whatever it comes next time, because it will be different. And we've also got to have a mechanism for getting on top of the long-term effects of this virus, because that's something none of us expected. You know, this was obviously a nasty virus, but it causes long-term effects in a high proportion of people, which nobody knew at the beginning of 2020. We have to deal with that.
OK, I just want to go to Magella there, because Anthony mentioned care homes as being one of the areas that will have to be looked at in this inquiry. And we were saying at the beginning of the programme, Magella, that, you know, for many of us, you put your hands in your ears when you think of COVID and you don't want to go back there and you don't want to be reminded. But for some of the families that you represent, they haven't been able to move on, have they? They haven't been able to leave COVID behind.
No, you know, we often hear people referring to the fact that they can't remember particular times in COVID. But for our families, they're frozen in time, you know, and they're frozen in grief. And an awful lot of that, you know, is because families are denied answers. They're denied freedom of information, particularly in private nursing homes, because they don't fall under the Freedom of Information Act. So our families don't know, in many cases, what happened to their loved ones. Our family members in wave three died the very same as they died in wave one, often alone, not having seen their loved ones for weeks or months on end. And, you know, and we can talk, you know, I always hear the word witch hunt when I'm ever brought into an interview. Our families are not out looking for a witch hunt. We're out looking for a human rights representation of what occurred in care settings, particularly for those for older people, and, you know, similar in hospitals and in all residential care settings. But we believe, you know, the public inquiry must have a human rights expert, the same as, you know, be it a medical expert or a legal expert or whoever else is there. Residents, particularly in nursing homes, we believe were seen as, they were seen through a medical lens. They weren't seen as human beings with emotions. They weren't seen as human beings with, you know, with desires and been able to make choices. So, like, to give a very clear example, in wave three, of the pandemic, we had people still being denied window visits. But yet in the summer of 2020, across different countries in Europe, they have put in place a visitor where a family member could come in like a partner in care. In Northern Ireland, in November 2020, the Northern Ireland executive endorsed a care partner system, which basically meant that two family members in rotation would be seen as a complete partner in care at all times in a care setting. And that took huge pressure off care staff, you know, at a time where we're hearing that there was no staff in care homes. Our family members wanted to go in. We wanted to help our loved ones.
Able to.
But everybody else across Europe could.
And I know you have been talking about this and your organisation has been talking about this and calling for this inquiry for some time, and you say the members that you represent are frozen in time. Have they been contacted by this inquiry?
No. We have on numerous occasions. We always engage with government, you know, not very successfully, But we always ask because we believe that we have the lived experience of policies which failed our older people. And we believe this is not just an issue for those of us who are impacted during COVID. You know, we're all getting older and we're going into a system that has very little regulation. So, like, we have been contacting government, we've put in submissions to the Health Committee of what we believe needs to happen in the reform of care so that nobody else will ever suffer the way my family and other families have continued to suffer as a consequence of what we believe are poor decisions okay. that occurred during COVID.
All right, let me just go back to Brendan O'Shea, and I'm going to let you come in on that too, John Lahart. I'm just when I hear Magella and I know the people that she represents who want answers about what happened in specific nursing homes. They want the chain of command. They want to know the, I suppose, correspondence between the nursing home and the HSC and what happened to their loved ones. Are they going to get that level of detail in a report like this?
I don't have an answer to that question. It's clearly important. And I have to say, I think all of us in just reflecting on this, it's actually shocking to bring ourselves right back into that space. Mm-hmm. An important part of recovering from it is being able to forget it and to move on. But clearly there are thousands of households where there's a deep level of hurt in terms of what actually happened. So it's really important that this inquiry happens. As a GP, I think we would all say that in general practice. It's very important that it happens in a timely manner. If it goes to 18 months, and then if we're sitting around for another couple of months before it's actually released, and then if there are recommendations, and then if it takes several more years for those recommendations to be acted on, that's not good enough for Ireland in 2024.
People... And isn't there a difficulty and a possibility that that will happen here? I mean, we're already 4 years into this. We're talking, I think initially Leo Varadkar said 12 months, but he said it could go to 18 months. And he did also say when these things happen, you can't really control the timeline.
I'm afraid there's absolutely a possibility that it might string out and happen like that. And I think it's important for all of us to get together and make sure that it doesn't happen like that and that the importance of the inquiry is not a witch hunt. It's not to punish. It's to understand what happened. It's particularly to understand what we did right and what do we need to do differently. And what do we need to do in order to be prepared for the next one, which inevitably will happen. So it's a very important inquiry and hopefully that we can actually keep the impetus and the urgency and have it deliver in a timely manner and act on the recommendations.
Yeah, because you say that there were positives that came out of
this. Huge positives.
Particularly for GP practice and how you run your business.
Well, it sounds very wrong to say that we had a good pandemic because it was awful. But things actually changed during the pandemic. And in certain respects, I don't think practice is ever going to go quite back to the way it was. For years, we had been hounding the powers that be. Could we have electronic prescribing? Could we have electronic certification? Mm-hmm. Suddenly, on a Tuesday in April 2020, it just switched on. So that was good. Everybody worked hard and with success. And I think that's an important thing to actually understand that. I think any of us who are practicing in Ireland looked across the Irish Sea and thought, boy, I'm glad I'm not trying to practice medicine in the UK. The United States was even worse. In Ireland, we had the rollout of immunisation ahead of everybody else practically in Europe. We got lots of things right.
OK, John Lahart, I just want to go back to one of the things that Magella said, that, you know, her organisation and those who lost family members and don't feel they can move on from COVID, that they have tried to get to reach out to get answers for a long time and they effectively have been ignored by government. Why?
Well, I don't think there's anything, you know, we as public representatives of the government should fear about this if it's structured properly. And as Anthony said, you know, I'm completely open-minded about public-private mixture of both. I like the idea, and I suspect people who may have harrowing stories to tell may opt sometimes to tell those stories in private once they are reflected in the publishing final report. Of the inquiry. In terms of not being consulted, I just wonder, because I understand that the government is carrying out a scoping inquiry, which I imagine is to see, OK, what do we cover here? They, again, from what I can glean, there will be a modular approach. There will possibly be a judge with some experts. So there'll be a structure to this and it will be broken into different pieces.
But will those families get the answers? You know, will they get the sort of level of detail, I wonder, in terms of what happened in, let's say, for example, individual care homes? Unlikely.
I think we should try and get as close to that as possible. But also bear in mind, I don't want to belittle anybody's pain. Everybody I know and every family I know experienced a death, OK? We had very few excess deaths in Ireland. You know? And there's one group, I've always said if I was talking about this on television, who I'd like to pay huge tribute to, who are never mentioned. I mean, we do mention, and rightly so, nurses, GPs, doctors, teachers, all of those, police, the guards, everybody, people in the stores. Undertakers have never, ever been mentioned. And you know what? They did their job quietly, with incredible dignity, and brought families through an incredibly harrowing period in their lives without any kind of fuss or without any kind of fanfare. And they're a group that
they should be recognised. Yeah. Do you think, Michael, that this could potentially make uncomfortable reading for members of NPHET and for politicians?
It has that potential. There's no doubt about it, because, you know, you can't control something like that, this. And particularly, it's politically sensitive in an election year. This is the government that, you know, it's coming to the end of its term. It oversaw COVID. It's not a new government, you know, in the first, we'll say, year of its existence and that. So this, you know, there will be judgments on the government inevitably.
Because it's a lot more, isn't it, than just the health service? I mean, they do have to look at the impact, I suppose, on closing down so much of the health service.
Absolutely.
On closing schools.
Lockdown.
On shuttering businesses. Yeah, yeah. On closing down the construction sector. All of those aspects
absolutely
need to be included in this,
absolutely,
don't they?
Absolutely. And the trauma of people had to endure. And the critical will be the terms of reference. Also critical will be the chairperson and the panel, if there is a panel, that will oversee this. And also, I agree, actually, that it's not something that should go on and on and on. As we've seen, we'll say, with tribunals in the past, people will want it, obviously, to hear what has to be said, but they will want it concluded in a reasonable length of time. They will want to see the conclusions and then the recommendations implemented.
Yeah, who should be on the panel, Anthony?
I think you're going to need a fairly substantial range of people with expertise in various areas in the panel. You're certainly going to need people who understand about pandemic control, but you're going to need economists, you're going to need psychologists, you're going to need human rights people.
And I'm glad to hear... Were those voices lacking, do you think, in decision-making during the pandemic?
Possibly, yes. I think the economists got a substantial shot at it, but I think one of the things NPHET didn't do is they didn't do risk assessments on their various policies. And there are procedures for doing rapid risk assessments which are routinely used in this sector. And I'm glad to hear it's a modular inquiry, but it's going to be really important that a module is done and reported, because parts of this could take a very long time. And giving a fair hearing to the families, that's a process that could take a very substantial period of time. And I think it'd be a terrible mistake to hold everything else in the reports until that process was finished, because either you're putting huge time pressure on it, or you never get anywhere with it.
Or it'll be like the banking inquiry, by the time it's published, we've all really left that period of time behind.
Doing it module by module by module, providing a report to the modules. That's been done for other inquiries in other countries, and it works well.
Yeah. I'm just very conscious, I suppose, of one of the recommendations that I will expect to come out of this report, Brendan, and I'm no medical expert, but it will look at ICU capacity in this country, because it was one of the reasons that we had such severe lockdowns, as we had a shortage of ICU capacity. We don't need a recommendation or report in this country to tell us that shortage was in existence. We knew that well in advance of COVID ever coming into the country. So I suppose I'm being sceptical and wondering, will these recommendations go anywhere?
Well, that's down to everybody and our collective responsibility and our collective interest. I think a really critical input into this, and it's very important that families and patients are represented in this, not as participants, but in terms of being involved in the expert panel overseeing this.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I think that's a really important way to get the right energy and the right focus on it. That's important.
Okay, I just want to ask you another thing while I have you here, as we're talking about, you know, care capacity within our hospitals. We've seen soaring rates of flu and actually of COVID again. What impact is that having on our hospitals?
Well, surely we can't.
And on GP practices.
Surely we can't be remotely surprised. This has happened every single winter back to 1066. It's utterly predictable. I suppose it seems scarier after the pandemic and the experience we've all been through. It also seems scarier, whereas before, in previous decades, it was just another bad winter of bugs. Now we've got them all named and lined up and they populate our imagination. It's RSV is the latest thing. It's happening. It was curious to see that there wasn't a major winter initiative heading into this winter. We could be cynical about it, that they were all part of heading into the winter, and glad to see that we didn't have one. But it is the way it is. And looking at it from general practice, you have to say that people are brilliant with it, that parents are working very hard. An awful lot of people are doing the right thing. We've gotten better at understanding in relation to antibiotics. But there are still margins where we can improve things.
OK, was there cynicism there, John Lahart? We didn't have the big, as he says, the big initiative, the big plan, because ultimately it hasn't really had any huge notable impact for the last couple of years.
Well, one of the things the minister introduced this year was an all-year-round approach to urgent and emergency care, as opposed to just kind of approaching that in the winter period.
And do you think it's working?
Well, certainly the stats that we have around the particular specific Christmas period, there was an 80% drop in those people who were on trolleys. Dr. Colm Henry today, I think, also talked about, you know, there's a reduction, could be more, there's a reduction. But you have all that pressure coming on. I think the next 2 weeks are the peak piece, and there is the post peak, which obviously can go on. People can still avail of vaccinations. That's okay. An important piece, and it's obviously the most pressured time of the year for the health service. But I think they're coping better this year than last year, and the stats so far seem to bear that out.
Okay, and I'm sure we'll discuss that in a lot more detail over the next fortnight. We're going to have to leave that discussion there for now. My thanks to John, Michael, to Anthony, Brendan and to Magella. Coming up, it's the environmentally friendly option, we're told, but are electric vehicles cut out for long journeys and the lack of infrastructure on Irish roads? Two leading Irish journalists are going to debate. Well, sales of electric vehicles rocketed by 45% in 2023, despite some concerns over car batteries and the availability of charging points by some. Well, joining us to debate whether EVs are a prudent investment from the Irish Independent is technology editor Adrian Weckler and motoring editor Geraldine Herbert. You're both very welcome to the programme. Adrian,
yep.
You've wanted to drive an electric car for a long time and last year decided, shell out the money, I'm jumping in and buying my electric car. Result?
Result, I bought it. I bought it.
What did you buy?
I bought a Volkswagen ID.3, the first new car I ever bought, only because at the time they were actually cheaper to buy than second-hand versions of the same car. It was roughly the same price at the time for about an 18-month-old version of the same car. So I've been used to driving electric cars for almost a decade. In the early years, I would have driven the Nissan Leaf for a while, reviewed a few cars after that. So I went into it with my eyes open, had always wanted to drive electric, fundamentally believe in the shift from petrol and diesel, from fossil to electric. We all pretty much need to do that. There have been challenges. There have been challenges. I knew there would be, but there definitely have been challenges.
Okay, let's talk about, I suppose, the first one. Like, and we all know, for many of us, buying a car, particularly buying a new car, it's a pretty significant financial outlay. And we know that new cars, you know, lose money as soon as you drive them off the forecourt. But the depreciation has shocked you.
Well, yes, it did in my case. Now, let me preface this by saying, this is an unbelievably first world problem. But when I bought, within, I'd say, 7 or 8 months, certainly in the last 2 months, many of the main electric car brands in Ireland have slashed their price. So the car that I bought, for example, came down by around 6,000 or 7,000 euro.
So you just lost that value really overnight.
In addition to the normal depreciation value. So were I to change, say I wanted to buy a plug-in hybrid now, for argument's sake, I'm not going to, but if I did want to, the gap that I would have to make up to do that in depreciation would be double the normal depreciation gap. Now, ironically, that could mean that you won't see that kind of a price drop again. But for those who bought last year, like I did, Tesla, Nissan, Volkswagen, they've seen a considerable drop in the value of their car.
Do electric cars in general, Geraldine, depreciate quicker than petrol or diesel cars?
No, I think what we're seeing in the market at the moment, and you bought, unfortunately, at a time when we had used car prices were at an exceptionally high price. There was a very long wait for new cars. That was having a big impact on car prices. At the same time, at the other end, there were various different things that happened in China. Tesla decided to, in order to grow their market share in China, to cut their prices. They then made the decision to globally do that. That put huge pressure on European car manufacturers to do the same. And then we had the entrance of Chinese car makers coming into the market, producing very well-specced and very well-priced cars, and the whole thing together has put enormous pressure on the European car market.
So Adrian was really unlucky?
It was unlucky. Now, the other thing, that's where we are now. The other thing I would say about depreciation is no car is an investment. As you point out, the minute you drive it off the forecourt, you've lost a huge amount of money. But the depreciation, the biggest chunk really is in the first 3 years. So that's why nobody sells a car after the first year. And to view depreciation in just terms of the first year is to not see the full picture. Over those 3 years, it will depreciate. But the thing you have to consider is that... I just lost my train of thought there for 1 second. Okay, in terms of the depreciation, the majority of people buying electric cars in Ireland are buying them on PCPs. With a PCP, and Volkswagen in particular, because they sell the best-selling electric car, and about 75% of those cars are sold on PCPs. With a PCP, the dealer will say to you, right, your car is worth this now. It'll be worth this at the end of the 3 years, and this is what you're going to pay every month. So you leave the dealership, you drive off with your brand new car, knowing exactly what your car is going to be worth at the end of the 3 years.
Do they depreciate more?
No, there are no surprises, there are no shocks, there are no nothing. You know exactly, and that price is guaranteed at the end. So there is no reason to believe...
But let's just say you didn't do PCP. Does an electric car depreciate quicker than a petrol car over that 3 year period?
No.
Or at a higher rate?
No, and there's no reason to believe that if you buy now, that in 3 years' time, it's going to. What has happened in the market, what I'm trying to explain, is there's been a number of factors that have happened, and there's been a lot of price reductions and artificial price increases at the beginning of that. So it was just unfortunate timing, but you cannot draw conclusions from depreciation for 1 year on what will happen in 3 years' time. And the dealership that you're buying on a PCP, for example, they're predicting what that value will be in 3 years' time, and they are guaranteeing that. So there is a lot of guarantee and a lot of certainty in the market in that sense.
Okay, so you got unlucky. Do you accept that, Adrian, in terms of the factors that Geraldine pointed out?
Oh, I do, absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, a friend of mine bought a Tesla Model 3. 2 weeks later, the price came down by, I think, 7,000 euro. So, look, that happens. This is this is a very small violin that you're going to play for for me on this.
Yeah, but people and it is the time of year when people are considering perhaps a new car, and a lot of people want to shift to electric, and they're
the fall in price that I have suffered, and that fair few people have suffered, is nowhere near the biggest challenge or issue with changing to electric.
Sorry, Adrian, can I just make one point there? But you haven't suffered a price loss only unless you went in to trade it in now. And nobody buys a new car and trades it in within a year.
If I were to go and buy, say, a plug-in hybrid or a hybrid car, if I decided that...
But that's a very unusual thing for a new car buyer to decide at the end of a year, I'm going to trade in a car. And in fairness, to make generalisations about the electric car market, you have to look at... In all new car markets, people hold on to cars for 3 years. So you cannot talk about depreciation based on a year. If you do that,
in
you
3 years
are an outlier.
Time, if we take Geraldine's time, if in 3 years' time, if I were to trade in against a hybrid, for example, a plug-in hybrid, it's almost certain that I will have lost a lot more value because I bought electric. Now, I'm willing to take that because I do believe in driving electric. But as I said, that's not actually the biggest problem with changing to electric.
Okay, your big problem recently was an experience with range. Tell me what happened.
So... The thing that they generally don't tell you when you move to electric, you have to do your own research, and you're well advised to do your own research. They don't tell you, for example, in general, in the winter, your range can fall by up to half. So I drove here in the M50, for example, tonight. Now, because it's cold outside, because it's winter outside, the range that I would have been getting would have been just a little over half of what the normal over the average year range is. So There
and it's a pretty cold country, Ireland.
Well, it's average temperature about 10 to 11 degrees. But the in cold, there are a lot of factors that will affect your range with an electric car. One is the weather. Okay, if it gets cold, if you put the heater on, if you've got somebody else sitting in the car with you, if you go over a certain speed, for example. Now, these are all things I was aware of, by the way. But it is quite amazing how many people don't know that and get a nasty shock. And it's quite amazing that there isn't a system in place, a consumer a regulatory practice in Ireland, which obliges some kind of basic understanding or information about this. You have to go hunting for it yourself. And I think it's basic, it's fundamentally disingenuous.
Geraldine, basically the electric car companies are being a little disingenuous with people. When they tell you the range of a new car, they don't actually tell you that it's dependent on loads of factors. Like Adrian says, who's in the car with you? Have you the heater on? And is it cold outside tonight?
OK, the WLTP figure is based on a mix of roads. So if you go...
This is the range figure for
people. This is the range figure. It's also the fuel consumption figure for a nice car, a petrol or diesel car. So if you go in an urban area, the chances are you're going to exceed that range. If you are on a motorway, you're not going to achieve it. Having said that, having driven a huge number of electric cars, some of them are closer. The real world range is far closer to the predicted range or the WLTP range than others. So that does vary from car to car. The only thing I would say, the WLTP, whether it's the fuel consumption on a petrol or diesel car or it's the range on an electric car is not what you're going to achieve. That's not what it's designed to do. It's designed as a comparison tool, so it allows you to compare one car to another. That's actually what it's designed to do.
But don't people sort of look at that, though, Geraldine? No, people look at that and think, oh, that's the range of the car. I'm somebody who lives in Donegal.
I want to go from Dublin to Cork. I want to go from Dublin to Cork.
OK, for the simple reason, exactly as Adrian is saying, the actual fuel consumption in a petrol car or in an electric car, the electric range is based on how many people are in the car, the weather conditions, the driving conditions, how aggressively you drive, how your speed and all of those things. So in an ICE car, it also matters, but we don't notice it because we're on the motorway and we can zip off and we can refuel in 2 seconds. If you take somewhere like Norway, right, they'd buy the same ICE car or the same electric cars with the same range problems, with the same WLTP figures, and yet 80% of their new cars are electric. And that's because they made a decision when they started off in terms of promoting electric cars, they would build the infrastructure first and then they would sell the cars.
I suppose the point so Adrian's making is we're not at that point in Ireland, so maybe consumers always, don't have enough information here.
No, but their infrastructure is always ahead of the number of cars on the road. Our problem is we're playing catch-up. When we should have invested in the infrastructure was in 2019 when we made our ambitious plans. Our electric cars would be far more usable. What Adrian is essentially highlighting is the problem is the infrastructure, not the car.
Is it the infrastructure, though?
No, it is. So the range and infrastructure are the two issues. So the fact that my car, which has an advertised range of 420 kilometres, cannot do Dublin to Cork on the motorway, which is 260 kilometres, unless I take the speed right down and other mitigating measures. This happened to me last week, OK? Unless I take the speed right down, that wouldn't be a problem if we had more than a handful of high-speed chargers. So the road that I do most is Dublin to Ballinat. It's 236 kilometres. There's one high-speed charger. Actually, there's more than one now because the Tesla chargers have opened up in Enfield. But up for a long time, one high-speed charger.
OK, but just to be clear, it didn't do the range that you
but
think it should be.
Adrian's experience in one car. Is it Adrian's
driving in that car? Is it a particular car?
No. I mean, Adrian obviously has driven a lot of electric cars. He knows how to get the maximum out of the range. But Adrian could drive a car with the exact same range, a different car, and get that. What I'm saying is it does vary from car to car. And it is unfair to take one example and say that is indicative of all electric cars. I have driven to Cork without any problem, going either from Dublin or going from where I live in Naas and not had an issue and done it many times in an electric car. So it is quite possible to do. It wasn't possible for Adrian in his ID3, but that's not to say it's not possible for him to achieve that in another electric car.
The point is, it sometimes is, and this is the point we're trying to get across, it sometimes is possible to do Dublin to Cork in my ID3 in the summertime, but not in the wintertime. The road I do most from Dublin to North Mayo, which is, 260 kilometres, I can do that all day long in the summertime on about 85% of battery. In the wintertime, I have to stop. Now, that's fine. That's fine. You know that when people like myself and Geraldine know that when we go into buying.
Do other people, though, buying cars know that, Geraldine?
I actually think they do. I think car buyers are probably more savvy about these things than they ever have been, because there's a wealth of information out there and they do avail of it. The AA have produced some great videos about, you know, 120 kilometres versus 100 in terms of your range. And Derek Riley and Nevo has great real world examples of driving. So there's huge amounts of information. And I find when people come
to people aren't being duped or being sold.
No, I literally get emails on a daily basis from people. They could be not necessarily buying electric, but considering things, and they are so well up on these things. So I don't believe for a second they are. And I do think, you know, it is not in the interest of car dealers to say to you, oh, you'll get 400 kilometres if you're not going to, because you're not going to come back to them. So it,
do you agree,
it
Adrian?
Works for nobody, that sort of...
I can't really fully agree with that. I agree with the gist of what Geraldine is saying, but... I think that car dealers and the car industry in general, if there is not regulatory oversight on how they sell their cars when it comes to ranges, I think they will sell the cars. And
but
I
they
don't
have any control over that. The WLTP is
they
not
could
controlled
tell you, they
by
could
the
tell
car
you
the industry.
Truth.
It's they the European
be the
Commission.
They could put on their websites... The range is 420 kilometres. By the way, in the wintertime, you might only get 270 kilometres.
A lot of them do. And I mean, Skoda have a great tool where you can actually put in the weather, the whatever, the amount you have in the car, the whole thing. But what I'm trying to say is that, you know, range comes down to a huge number of factors. Having four kids in the car, three kids in the car, a roof rack, stuff in the boot. So it's you cannot generalise based on one journey in one car.
It's a lot of things for people to take on board, though, isn't it? It's just not as straightforward, perhaps,
but fuel
I think, as the industry
the same,
has sold it to be in Geraldine.
But fuel consumption is exactly the same. But we don't notice because we have the ability to literally refuel anywhere in minutes. So it does come down to the fact that if the charging infrastructure was ahead of the game and was ahead of the numbers, we wouldn't be having this
what
discussion.
What would massively help and maybe solve it is if government ministers and senior policymakers actually drove electric cars, I think you'd pretty soon see more public infrastructure out there.
Would you do it again?
Yes, I'm committed to driving electric. The fact that I keep giving out about the range and about the crap public infrastructure is an inverted love letter to electric cars. I want to keep driving electric cars.
Okay, just get a bit better at the infrastructure. All right, Geraldine Herbert and Adrian Rector, thank you both for coming in to us. After the break, Oscar Pistorius out on parole after serving half of his 13-year sentence. We'll bring you the very latest. Trial that gripped the world, and tomorrow South African Paralympic sprinter Oscar Pistorius will be released on parole from prison after serving half of a 13-year sentence for murder of his then-girlfriend Reeva Steenkamp. I'm joined now live from Pretoria in South Africa by news correspondent Ollie Barrett for more on this. Ollie, good to speak to you as always. I think many of us will remember the details of this trial, will remember the footage, the live footage coming from the trial and Oscar Pistorius himself giving evidence. But remind people who perhaps have forgotten of the details of this case, if you can.
Well, Kira, it was Valentine's Day 2013 that Oscar Pistorius shot and killed Reeva Steenkamp, his girlfriend, through the bathroom door at his property here in Pretoria. He claimed at the time, and is still claiming as far as we know, that he thought that she was an intruder. But as you say, there was that incredibly high-profile trial with those pictures beamed around the world as he and others gave evidence in court. He was initially convicted of culpable homicide, which is something akin to manslaughter in many other jurisdictions around the world. But after a tussle between various courts and lawyers here in South Africa, that was changed to a conviction for murder with that 13-year sentence to go with it. And as you say, he has now served over half of that 13-year sentence. And it's that sentence that we now see him released under those parole conditions.
What is the justification, I suppose, for his early release, Ollie? And what will those parole conditions be?
South African authorities say that this is following the exact procedure that they would always follow for any criminal in the judicial system here in South Africa, for any criminal who served over half their sentence in a case like this and in other cases as well. They say that there is nothing unusual about the release on parole at a time like this during a sentence like this. Those parole conditions will include Oscar Pistorius having to live at a designated address here in Pretoria, not far from where I am, in a suburb of the city, which is called Waterkloof. He'll stay with his uncle. He'll have to be at that property for a number of designated hours per day. He will not be allowed to drink alcohol. He will not be allowed to give media interviews. If he wanted to take up any employment opportunities, he would have to talk to his parole official to get all of that okayed. We also understand that he will have to take part in various programs related to gender-based violence and anger management, things like that. In terms of how the actual day turns out, because we are into Friday now here in South Africa, it's around 1 a.m. in the morning. Officials here have only said that he will be released at some point on Friday. They've also said that people who are camped out and journalists are camped out at the prison where he's been serving his time recently, they say they will not see pictures of Oscar Pistorius today, leading to speculation about exactly what that means about the nature and the timing of his release on Friday. But once he has been released from prison, we do expect him to make his way to his uncle's house in that suburb of Pretoria, Waterkloof, not far from where I am now, to serve out the remaining period of his sentence. So he will be under those parole conditions until the end of 2029.
Now, we know, Ali, that South Africa has some of the highest rates of gender-based violence in the world, and we know how high-profile this case was and, indeed, how high-profile he was. What are those advocacy groups saying, and what are Reeva Steenkamp's own family saying about his early release?
That's absolutely right. You have to remember that at the time of the killing of Reeva Steenkamp, Oscar Pistorius had come off the back of the London Olympics, in which he'd competed alongside other non-disabled athletes. He brought home a haul of medals in the Paralympics in London as well, and in Beijing before that. And that did shine a huge spotlight on the issue of gender-based violence here in South Africa. And so there are campaigners here in South Africa today who are saying Oscar Pistorius should not be being released early. It sends the wrong message. Now, there are others who say that in a way it can shine a light on the progress that has been made in this country on gender-based violence, but they also say that it also shines a light on how much further there is to go on these issues. And that's one of the great areas of controversy around Oscar Pistorius's release. But as I say, officials insist, they absolutely insist, that they are following the normal procedures here, that he is not receiving any special treatment.
All right, we're going to leave that there for now. Ali Barrett, live in Pretoria, thanks for speaking to us this evening. Well, that is it from us here on The Tonight Show. Our programme, as always, is available as a podcast on all major platforms. And you can also find us on Instagram and on TikTok tonight, VMTV. But from all the late team here, good night and do take care.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.